This evening, this retreat, in fact, is an opportunity. I've been sharing my insights with you over the past few days, and not to brag or anything like that. But when you've been pursuing something for 40 years, you do. You know, it hasn't been a waste. I'm not disappointed with it. As I often feel very fortunate because coming from a society where, you know, Buddhism was not part of the expectation of my parents, and I was brought up as a good Anglican, and the good fortune, the what they call barami, maybe, or whatever it is, to have come across teachings of the Buddha, and then having opportunities to practice them for so many years, so that the thing that attracted, that reached me when I first discovered Buddhism was the fact that of its practicality. It's not a belief system. And having been brought up as a Christian, you know, when I started in my adolescence, when I started questioning the doctrines, Christian doctrines, and realized I had to believe in things that didn't make any sense to me. And so I couldn't do it. The mind just found it impossible to just believe in things that actually didn't. I found I couldn't see the point of even believing in them. And there was always this pressure, you know, of going to hell or being punished or being doubtful, not believing. But also, having a skeptical nature, a questioning nature, then I somehow, with all the intimidation of going to hell if I gave up Christianity, I just thought, well, if God is going to send me to hell for this, maybe I don't want to go and live with God, because he's a terrible tyrant, because my intentions are good. You know, I wasn't just being bloody-minded or seeking, you know, an excuse to commit crimes and do evil deeds. So in trusting your own intention, you know, like so many people suffer from fear and fear of being punished, and they might be wrong, and maybe the mistakes in their life, they're going to be punished for those kind of things, or for, you know, torturing your school teachers or whatever terrible things you've done in the past. And of course, this is the thinking mind, and we can always create doubts. You know, what's going to happen when we die? What do Buddhists believe about death? Do you go to heaven or hell or nirvana or just oblivion or whatever, reincarnation? But notice that the way I'm reflecting during this retreat is pointing it always at the present. You know, it's not theoretical knowledge. I'm not asking you to believe on anything that I'm saying as some kind of, you know, that I'm telling you what you should think or how you should practice. But an attempt to awaken, to inspire you, or to give you a confidence that in the ability to realize truth, you know, it's your It's your human right. It's something that's natural to us. It's not, you're not finding something, you know, in outer space, something so far out that the ordinary human being couldn't possibly expect to realize Nibbana, because it's, you know, that's for Superman or special kind of human beings. And so, you know, just by the Buddha's first sermon of the Four Noble Truths, he's establishing a teaching that's been carried on for 2,550 years based on just the most ordinary human experience of dukkha or suffering. It's ordinary, nothing like having been tortured or, I mean, this is suffering too, but you don't need to go to have extreme suffering, just the suffering of ordinary, middle class, comprehensive school. You don't even need to have attended the public school to realize. In fact, it might be more difficult. But the ordinariness, is the sense of ordinariness, now that's not inspiring, we say the ordinary, is it? Because the society we live in is always looking for the extraordinary. You know, the peaks, the heights, the success, the best. You want to conquer Mount Everest, go to the highest peak. You don't want to go to an ordinary mountain. You can't brag about that. I've climbed Glastonbury Tor. I see you laugh, you know. So notice that the sense of yourself is built not on recognizing the ordinary, but on comparing yourself and seeing yourself in extreme terms. So even if you think you're an ordinary person, that's more or less, you're almost ashamed of it, like it's something not to be proud of and something, you know, you're not extra special like others are. Now looking at because we admire, you know, the celebrities, isn't it? They call it the celebrity culture now, because they're quite kind of untalented, boring people become celebrities. So just having your name in the papers and being called a celebrity is making one special. If everyone was a celebrity, it wouldn't mean much. Now but then we're looking at suffering, not even though it's ordinary, it's what everybody experiences in their lifetime. It's still, you know, it's usually something that we turn away from, we try to get rid of, we run from, or you know, we think it unfair that we have this idea we should be happy as a kind of continuous emotional state of just being secure and happy. But that's an extreme, isn't it? The nature of this very realm is insecure. It's all about change. There's nothing stable in it. What we seek security in is always changing. That's when we really investigate the sankharas or phenomena. You know, and so this changingness is the ordinariness of insecurity, of uncertainty, of not knowing, where in the desire is to know, to have answers to questions and solutions to problems, to know who we are. We want to know who am I, and what is my role in society, what will happen to me when I die, where do I belong in the world, there's a lot of questioning going on about, who your ancestors or country of origin or whatever. Am I American or British? This doesn't bother me at all because I don't really care, but I could make a problem about it, an identity crisis. Now, the awaking, this mindfulness, awakenness, doesn't have any nationality or anything like that. And so it's not in trying to define yourself anymore. So you don't need to define yourself and have a name for yourself and all that, but you just need to know what is not self. So when we use this word anatta, sape dhamma anatta, sape sankaranicha, all conditions are impermanent, sape dhamma anatta, all the truth is not any kind of personal thing, is not self. So this sense of a self we create, as I've been said many times during this retreat, you create yourself, your identities. And just notice this in your own, what you think you are, the things you identify with, like nationality, class, gender, race, social position, talents, sexual inclinations. All these things become identities that define us, religion. We define ourselves according to either Theravadan or Mahayana or Zen. Now we can see that this is that the sense of a person, a separate person, is created through not that any of these identities are wrong and you shouldn't do it, but really start questioning: are any of these things really, any of these identities really? And you really, when you really look at them, they're really nothing much. And if you become obsessed with some identity, then you're always threatened when it's being condemned or being criticized or people, have prejudices or aversions or opinions. And so we, like identifying with the aging process. Then one becomes an old person by identifying with the age, or in the monastic life, like the Buddha established the Sangha, and so he established the bhikkhuni orders, and these are not kind of worldly titles. They're alms mendicants. They mean you depend on the kindness of others. So it doesn't have any kind of class identity. You're not kind of a priesthood, or you're kind of held up above working class or farmers or the rest. Because anybody, idea was that anyone who is healthy enough or whatever can become a monk or a nun. And so, but then the bhikkhu can be another identity, another, because people, in Buddhist countries you get so much respect, you almost feel like you're a high priest. And so if you're not careful, you start thinking identifying with being an alms mendicant. But you don't think of it as alms mendicant, you think more of it as... In fact, a lot of bhikkhus don't even bother to go on alms route anymore, because they can stay in their air-conditioned kutis and people will bring them the food that they want. But how to use these titles, these names, in order to not be attached, not to create more identities, or being senior, even the monastic sangha, I'm the most senior monk, and I'm the abbot, or things like this. I'm the ajahn. I'm the, you can become very attached to being senior to somebody else. You get. It's funny how this monastic life brings up certain most silly reactions. Like you can get very upset if a junior monk goes before you in the food line. Because any of these conventions are kind of addictive, and they give you a security, of this is how it's done, and everybody follows the rules, and when anybody, there's any loose cannons or any oddballs, they rock the boat, they take everything up. Well, then this is suffering, isn't it? So even being a senior monk and a teacher and all the rest can, if grasped and identified with, is still suffering. It's not liberation. So liberation then is through awareness, awakeness, and through understanding all conditions are impermanent, which is not to be grasped as an idea, but to be noticed, tested out, see if you can find any permanent conditions. So when in Satipatthana, Four Foundations of Mindfulness, it's all about investigating phenomena. From coarse phenomena to refined. Now, when we talk about stream entry or sotapanna, now these words, there's four stages. When we chant in the Sangha, the salutation of the Sangha, we talk about the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. These are the Blessed One's disciples. Such ones are worthy of gifts, worthy of honor. And so everybody wonders, what are the four pair of the eight kinds of noble beings? And we chanted everything. What does that mean? And so, but this is about what we call stream entry. The first one is called stream entry or sotapanna. And then Sakadagami is once returner, Anakami, non-returner, Arahant. You've completed the course. Now these sound like stages that one wants to attain, doesn't it? And this is how the thinking mind works. And we all go through this when we first because that's how the thinking is. Thinking is hierarchical, isn't it? It's linear. Good, better, best, bad, worse, worst. That's just the way thinking operates. You can only have one thought in a moment. You can't think the same thought simultaneously. Now that seems obvious, but we're so used to thinking, so caught in the thinking process, that we try to think our way to enlightenment, or we think about ourselves endlessly and about our faults, or seeing ourselves oftentimes through our critical mind, you know, dwelling on the flaw or the imperfection or the fault, and tend to exaggerate our one's own kind of faults or flaws. So even on a personality level, people tend to be very self-critical, you know, so because we can find so many flaws in you know, I can find all kinds of things wrong with me on a personal level, emotional level. I can, you know, it's just the way my mind works. And then the faults and the flaws I can become obsessed with and ignore the virtues. And this is in Thailand, Ajahn Chah insisted that I recollect my virtues. Never thought of that before. You know, I was 33 years old, never thought of, you know, I always thought that would be like assuming I'm really good. It's like bragging or boasting. Might inflate me, my ego, if I start thinking, oh, I'm virtuous. And say, well, oh, I'm a sinner. I've done some pretty bad things. I've got all these faults. And that's like being honest, aren't I? Tell me about yourself. Well, I'm a virtuous, good-hearted... No, you're not. Tell the truth now. And I tell you, oh, my faults. He's really, you know, he's honest. He really tells you the truth. Because I might tell you about all the flaws and weaknesses that I can recognize in myself. But in terms of developing self-confidence or self-respect, this is another thing that, you know, like, people have criticized, I've been criticized for teaching like I do, and for teaching about anatta, non-self. Because some people think that, well, before you have a self you can let go of, you have to have a good self, a proper ego. And then you might go through years of psychoanalysis just to develop a good sense of yourself before you can let it go. Well, maybe it doesn't take 20 years of psychoanalysis. You know, it was fun, just in the Buddhist terminology, like dana sila, they have this sequence, dana sila bhavana. And so dana is a kind of generosity. Now this develops a sense of self-respect when you're generous. You know, when you share what you have with others, being generous is a kind of, you know, when you love to be generous, you start respecting yourself more than if you're just stingy and selfish and self-centered. You know, so if one just lives for me and what I can get and my rights and my interests and not develop generosity, it's not worthy of respect. I can't respect misers or selfishness in others, not to mention in myself. It doesn't mean I don't experience selfishness, but it's not a quality that I respect or that I want to cultivate and develop. And then sila is like the morality. Now, as I was saying before, this morality in this sense is taking a responsibility for one's life. Now, there's something I respect in that. I don't respect people that are always blaming everything for, you know, the victims of life. You know, I didn't get a chance, and my mother never really loved me, and all that kind of thing, even if it's true. And but there's something kind of noble and inspiring about somebody that takes responsibility. Okay, from now on, I'm responsible for how I live, what I do. And then that is, you know, I find I respect that when I see it in others and in myself. Now, when I lived a more dissolute life before becoming a monk, you know, where in the early 60s, you know, living in Berkeley, California, there was a kind of freedom, you know, where you were given license to more or less do anything you felt like. And so it was all kind of fun just to, you know, the idea that the philosophy at that time was experience everything. You know, no holds barred, no moral boundaries. Just do what, you know, follow your desires wherever they take you and see what happens. And so, I mean, that was kind of, you know, when you're young, that sounds quite tantalizing because a lot of po-faced adults, you know, he's saying, don't do that, and don't do that, and suddenly you're kind of, I can do anything I want now, free. But the result was, you know, I developed a lot of self-hatred just by following desires and just doing anything I felt like. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like being free and free spirit, you know, and filled with love and all the best that one was expecting, but just a sense of kind of increasing self-contempt. So just noticing in the structure of Theravada Buddhism that these very basic stages like Dana Sila are quite important really in just living in the world, living in society, learning to respect yourself even though there is no self. But that doesn't mean, you know, that's not the excuse. And if there's no self, then why bother to respect something that doesn't exist? But you don't know that. You see. You still live in a society where the self is totally believed in and one's committed to, you know, me and my rights and my feelings and everything else. That seems very personal. My identities. Now in bhavana, which is bhavana means cultivation of awareness. So notice the first two about living in the world in a useful way, you know, in a way that on a worldly level, if you want personal happiness in the world, then dana sila is the way to do it. You know, generosity and morality. And then, in spite of all that, with having self-respect, there's still something missing. Because the bhavana is where you see through the illusion of self. Now, the sotapanna is the first stage, you know, where you break through the illusions of self. So, in these four stages, there are 10 fetters. Now, this is a very clear map, actually, that's in the scriptures. I didn't make this up. So this is Orthodox Theravada, you know. So, and so the 10 fetters are they're called sanyojanas, and they're like manic. They bind us to delusion and to suffering. These fetters. So fetters like a manacle or something that handcuffs and things like that, straitjackets. They kind of hold you and bind you to unsatisfactory conditions. And so the first fetter is sakyaditti or the personality view. So this unquestioned allegiance to the sense of yourself as a separate person, your identities, and so forth are a fetter. You know, they prevent you from seeing or realizing nibbana. or realizing the path, the freedom that, because these, notice that the Sakya Ditti is something you acquire after you're born. And it's all about thinking and attachment to memory. So just the pronouns, me and mine, I am Ajahn Sumedho, me, mine, and these pronouns reinforce this sense of me. What am I getting out of this? What about me? And this is mine, and I am an Om's mendicant. I am a Mahatera. Now, these are conventions that we use to communicate and live in the conventional world. But now with bhavana, or cultivation, or meditation, put it into that common word, meditation. Real meditation begins at stream entry. Otherwise, you can get kind of samadhi experiences, but not, you don't see the path. You can't cultivate, you can't bhavana till you see through the first three fetters. Now, the first three fetters are all about cultural conditioning, personality view, and thinking. Language itself. So these are human creations, aren't they? They aren't kind of floating from the heavens above. We create language, we identify with culture, with social conditioning, and with the sense of myself as a man or woman or Buddhist or Christian or young or old. These are, you have to think these words and then they, and believe these words is what I really am. You know, this is the real me. And the body is another one, isn't it? The strong identity with the body. Recently renewed my passport and they asked for a photograph of my face on the passport. So the face is very strongly identified with. When you look in the mirror, you look at a reflection of your own face. And they never ask for, you know, I've got another unique characteristic at the opposite end, a big foot. And they won't let me use that in my passport. That's quite unique. Big swollen foot. So, that's noticing the face, and how we strongly identify with it or criticize it. When you look in the mirror, what happens? You start noticing your complexion and and when you get this age, you don't like to look in the mirror anymore. But when in bhavana, then meditation, we're actually, when we're doing this, in the morning, like observing the body. Now we're aware of the body as experience now, rather than as in terms of identity, identifying with it. It's a different way of looking, isn't it? You don't have to even see your body. You can close your eyes, but you can still feel it. It's obvious. It's sitting. It's like this. It's hot or cold, or the clothes you're wearing are pressing on it. Maybe your belt is too tight, or you're feeling all the time. This is being aware of the body. It's not creating an ego, but just recognizing it as conscious experience. The different way of experiencing your physical body. When you look in a mirror, then that arouses the critical mind and vanity. Because we give so much importance to what we look like and what we wear and on like that. Because that's, on the conventional world, that's society and the expectations we have on the ego level. So when I think I am my body is, I wish it were this way or that way, should lose weight and should, then I create a sense of myself. I become this person with this body. But if I aware, just with pure awareness, then the body still is operating, still what it is, but I'm not thinking about it in terms of me and mine. It's like this. I'm not comparing it, you know, with ideals or you know, with somebody else, but it's just the way it is, you know. This is what I can know here and now, is the body like this. And so there's no, it's not an ego, you're not creating a sense of ownership of it. You're beginning to recognize it, realize what it's like to have this human body the way it is. You know, it is a continuously changing, you know, we're always having to move it or feed it or do something with it. And, you know, for a whole lifetime, we've spent so much of our life just trying to keep the body from being too unpleasant. Because it's always, you know, never you when you bathe it and feed it properly, you can't stay that way for very long. Because this round the body is like this, the sensitive form, and so many things impinge on it, the temperature of the room, you know, the drafts through the windows, you know, the aging of the body, whether you're feeling pleasure or pain through it, or you're hungry or thirsty. Its functions are like this, and so this is a way of breaking down this sense of it being me and mine. It's phenomena. It's just like having a human body's like this. And then say with the sense of myself as a person, it's just thinking of I am Ajahn Sumedho. Well, I you know, that this is a conditioned identity. I wasn't born thinking I'm Ajahn Sumedho. In fact, the first 33 years, Sumedho was not even in my consciousness. I had a different name. But I am me and mine. These are the thought patterns and identities. And so, just now, in order to see this, you know, you pay attention to what you're thinking, not in a critical way, not to say you should or shouldn't think like this, but really think, you know, be egotistical, be completely egotistical and vain and self-obsessed, but listen to it. You know, that's what I did. I listened to my ego. Because just trying to get rid of it doesn't work. That's another ego again. So, in its you know, oftentimes it's absurdities or its obsessions, its moods. I would listen to it, like listening to you know, like watching television or listening to somebody talking on the other side of the fence. And I began to see, you know, how if I stop thinking and identifying with memories and that, if there's just pure awareness, there's no self. Now I use this, when I refer to this sound of silence, I don't know how many have noticed it yet. I keep bringing it up because it's very useful, because it does. It's the only real way to stop the thinking process, to be able to stop yourself thinking and just proliferating and analyzing about Buddhism or meditation or anything. If you begin to notice this resonating sound stream, it's like a high pitch or almost electric buzz. And it's all the time, it's not like people just don't notice. They aren't aware. Or if they do, they oftentimes think it's tinnitus or something, some kind of ailment. But I began to notice this in my first year when I was a Samanera. Began to observe this when I, being alone for so long, the thinking would stop and I'd just notice this. And if I stayed with this sound stream, it's quite peaceful. Now, I didn't know how to use it then, but I certainly became aware of it, at that time, before I even met Ajahn Chah. Then over the years, experimenting with it, especially here in England, it became, I remember we lived in London for the first 2 years, and I remember walking down, we lived in Belsize Park, in northwest London, and I remember one afternoon walking down Haverstock Hill, and at this time I was in a terrible state because the people that had invited me to England, the English Sangha Trust, they were having a terrible acrimonious battle, which I was in the middle of. And it's the last place I wanted to be, was in the middle of something, I didn't know what I was getting into when I accepted the invitation. So I arrive in London, find myself in a conflict between two sides in this English Sangha Trust. And it brought up all kinds of feelings, and I wanted to go back to Thailand. I want to go back. I didn't come here to. This is just worldly rubbish. And I became averse, But then, I remember walking down Haverstock Hill, and then suddenly, it's like this sound of silence attacked me. And literally, it's like it just overwhelmed me. Right on Haverstock Hill, which is a rather busy road in London. And then I thought, this is it. Just stay with this sound of silence and see what happens. So that was in the first year in living in of all places, London, on a busy street, across from a pub. So then over the years, developing this, because what it does is once recognized, then it stops this proliferating tendency of thought. Now, I'm not trying to get rid of thought, but if you don't know this, then one just thinks. And you acquire so much information about Buddhism and read so many Buddhist books. There's so many Buddhist teachers and Buddhist traditions, and not to mention other things. There's all kind. Here is a supermarket of religion, New Age philosophies, and everything else. So it's not that there's it's so many choices, options, opportunities for all kinds of things. So this does affect us, and then we find some, we get confused, we get inspired, we somebody comes along, that says, you should do it this way, or you should do it that way, and we, what are we to do? And there's so many things coming at us all at once. And just trying to solve it on that level of picking and choosing among the options, it doesn't you know, you can develop, maybe you have an inclination or preference for one over another. And it's good to follow that, whatever you feel most at ease with or attracted to. But still within that, even with Theravada Buddhism, it's clearly stated as it is. So there's so many opinions about how to practice. And so, you know, again, should you get the jhanas first, and then you've got to get fourth jhana before you do vipassana, and then you don't need the jhanas, just need mindfulness, and on like this. There's arguments. I hear on internet, there's kind of discussions worldwide on whether you need the jhanas or not. And what does this, you know, what does this do? And, you know, this is still thinking. And you know, do you need the jhanas or you don't need the jhanas or whatever? This is still proliferating of the intellect, isn't it? Do you need to take a stand on that level? Or orthodox Theravada? You know, what is, when they talk about orthodox Theravada, and so I don't think I'm considered orthodox Theravada. I'm a bit on the, radical side maybe. I don't know. I don't know how people look at me, but because there's a certain way people hold the Theravada teachings and interpret the scriptures. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with that, but what I'm pointing at is the attachment to the convention, the identity with it, with an intellectual opinion about practice, about yourself, about Theravada, about orthodoxy, about meditation or whatever. All good stuff, you know, nothing, not criticizing, but this, as long as you've not... If you're operating from sakyaditti, from the ego, from the self-view, you're never going to get it right. You're still, at the end of 40 years, you're not quite sure whether it was worth it. Or have I attained Srinatri or not? Now, These are not titles to identify with, because the thing I am a stream enterer is the Siddha Sakyaditti, isn't it? Using that word sotapanna with the pronoun I, is that how to use it? I don't like to use it like that. I wouldn't, you know, it doesn't make sense to me to see it in that way, or think I'm not a sotapanna, or I am. As people ask me, they say, what is your attainment? And I say, 40 years, Zaiba Vajan Cha. Have you attained anything? And then I say, well, are you a sotapanna? Well, are you an arahant? Well, no, that always is referring back to Sakyaditti, Silabhata Paramasa, Vicikicca. Now, those are the first three fetters. Now, these first three fetters are artificial things we create, human beings created. So it's the Sakyaditti is your ego. You create yourself by identifying with your memories and thoughts, views and opinions. Silabhata Paramasa is the second one, and that's oftentimes translated as clinging to rites and rituals. But I expand that because it's clinging to conventions. Clinging to the conventional, the conventions of even Buddhism. Attachment out of ignorance to even Buddhism itself is Silabhata Paramasa. And then Vicikicca is the Pali word for doubt, doubting, uncertainty. Now, doubting is a result of thinking. You know, when you think, you doubt. Am I a sotapanna or not? Well, I don't know. I don't know if I dare. I don't know if I even want to be, because then if I go around telling people I'm a stream emperor, you're really setting yourself up to be knocked down. So you must mention calling yourself an arahant. But that doesn't make sense in terms of Dhamma, identifying with these stages. And yet, the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, what are they? You know, what is that when we're paying respect to the Sangha? And so there's two stages to each level. So there's Sotapanna Magga, Sotapanna Pala, the path, you see the path, and the result of practicing that path. So, and then the Sakatakami Magga, so there's four kinds, four pairs, eight kinds. Now, what does that do to the Sakyaditi mind? You know, it's a rather boggling mind. It's figuring out Magga, Pala, path and fruit, and stream enterer, once returner, non-returner, and perfectly perfected. You know, those are words and descriptions and definitions. And as long as we try to figure that out on that level of thought and identified with, have I attained or achieved any of this, you'll get nowhere. Either you can be crazy sometimes and think you are arahant. I've done that. After intense meditation, I come out and I'm just completely enlightened. And I think, I'm an arahant. In fact, my third meditation lesson, I thought I was an arahant. I thought, I'm really a fast learner. Three lessons and I'm there. I thought it was going to take years. And only to find out that I wasn't, you know. It was so, you know, that's why these fetters, these first three fetters, I intentionally, deliberately investigate them so I know what Sakyaditi is. Not through just following scriptural definitions, but actually investigating my ego, the sense of myself, my fears, my doubts, my self-criticism. My memories, identity with the body, with the position, and whatever. Don't be afraid of it. You know, nothing. You know, just to get to know the ego, the Sakyaditi, is like this. Now, getting to know that, then stopping the thinking process, because then when you stop thinking and identifying, thinking about me and mine, and am I or am I not, or that, then there is consciousness and awareness and discernment. Now that is not Sakyaditi. That's not the ego. It's pure consciousness. It's intelligent. I'm not in a trance or a zombie or unconscious, fully conscious and awake, attentive. And I notice this sound of silence. It's like this. Then by developing this, resting in this sound of silence, because it's everywhere all the time. Once you begin to recognize it and appreciate it, you know, when it not doesn't, you know, when I, in middle of London or anywhere, you know, I'm aware of it right now talking. I have to notice it while I'm talking to you. Because it's like the space, and the space is still here, isn't it? Even if I'm talking, I'm going to be aware of the space. So this is like the background or the ground of being, put it in these terms, or the unconditioned. You're beginning to just, this is the unconditioned. I say, oh, I've realized the unconditioned. No, you can't do that. Sakyaditi again. There is no self-congratulation in this practice. You know, there's actually no attainment. So people say, you've been a monk 40 years, what have you attained? Nothing. Now that could sound really depressing, kind of. And you spent 40 years celibate and got nothing out of it. What a chip. Or, you know, talking in terms of Dhamma, it's, you know, what the realization of letting go, isn't it? It's not attaining. And so it's totally against the whole way of the world. The world that is based on the ego and convention and belief and attachment and achieving and proving yourself, you know, proving yourself to be successful or get the prize or be the winner or be somebody. So at the end of your life you say, well, I've done this and I've done that and I've, you know, done all these wonderful things. I must be somebody. But in the holy life, it's the exact opposite of that. It's not attaining, but letting go. Not through resisting or annihilation, but through understanding the way it is. So then also, you know, getting beyond your own cultural conditioning. You know, assumptions you make, we all... you know, from our social and cultural backgrounds, we all form assumptions about ourselves and the world we live in. So you have our ethnic biases or attitudes, you know, we oftentimes misunderstand people from different ethnic backgrounds or religions and whatnot because they aren't making the same assumptions. And living in monastic sangha here in England, it's very international. You know, you're getting people from all over. You know, we're not a common kind of, all from the same village in the Midlands. From everywhere. And different age groups and so forth. But this sound of silence then is a common factor. It's the ground of being. It's not ethnic. And it helps you to see what, you know, even assumptions you make. Unconscious, unrecognized attitudes and subtleties that are so part of us we can't get any perspective on, that we tend to misunderstand or create prejudices or whatever, or form views about others that are based on assumptions, cultural assumptions we have, we're holding to. Now, from this empty point, when we're talking about emptiness or this stillness or the sound of silence, then this is not personal and it's not cultural. So then you begin to see, you know, you can let go. You aren't bound to cultural conditioning, social conditioning, or to the way your personality operates. You're not limited and bound by what you think anymore. You've found liberation through awakened awareness, intuitive awareness. So then this is the path. This is from this point, these three fetters, it's like when you really investigate those and you have the insight into, you know, seeing them for what they are, you know, you don't. You can still work in the conventional world and operate, you know, in the society better than ever. But you're no longer limited by that, by the conditions. And when you're not limited and identified with the changing conditions and fears and desires, then you don't suffer. The suffering is all about, you know, fear and anger and resentment and jealousy and being attached and being judging and critical and having preferences and strong views and so forth. We endlessly create, you know, kind of miserable mental states and anxieties and worries haunt human consciousness everywhere. So then like stream entry is like, this is like you see this, you know this is real, this is not assuming anything from, you know, from overestimation of yourself, because you actually know the self, the Sakyaditi. You know what it is, and you know that this awareness is not self. I don't create, it doesn't have my name on it. And so then through this is called insight, knowledge, discernment, or punya. And then from this you cultivate this way of awareness. And then the rest takes care of itself, as you see. You know, the path of liberation is actually blocked off by the first three fetters, because all these are artificial identities, the ignorance and the ignorant attachment to these conditions just keep us in this vortex, this whirling vortex of samsara. We have no way of seeing it or understanding it. We're merely kind of caught in its movement. So this is for your consideration and reflection.